CliffCentral.com.
This show contains adult content. If you find it offensive, please go to the CliffCentral.com website where there's a show for you.
CliffCentral.com. It is Sex Talk with John T. Searle on Friday morning, unradio, unscripted, uncensored. And we're going deep. We're going into probably one of the darkest places of the human soul this morning. A place that it's hard to describe. And the more I was thinking about the topic, the more overwhelming it becomes, is the topic of rape. It's a scourge in South Africa. And some amazing people come to share their stories. So welcome, Mia Malan from Becky Sisa of the Mail and Guardian.
Thank you.
And you've got to talk really close to the mic.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And a beautiful woman, Hayley Rosenbach, come to share your story. And we are so grateful for that.
Thank you so much, Jonty.
Such an important topic. We've got to do something first, though.
Ninja sex.
Chocolate starfish.
Twitter bang.
Calipagian.
Today's dirty dictionary word is
heel dough.
Dirty dictionary word.
Heel dough. Any idea what a heel dough is, Hayley?
No idea.
Come on, take a guess.
In a whole different note.
Yeah.
In a whole different note. In a fun lifting up the spirit note.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds like some form of martial art.
Martial art. You are so far from that.
Maybe Hayley should know. This is it's a sex dictionary. Yeah.
So, Mia, any clue?
No clue.
Take a guess. Come on.
I have no idea.
Okay. Come on.
So, you know, the point is that it sounds like a dildo, heel dough, and I don't want to think about what it's, you know, a heel dough is, so I'm going to say it's not that. So it's some sort of dildo fetish or a dildo idea.
So you absolutely were right there.
Okay.
So it's a dildo that attaches to a heel with some kind of harness.
Okay. Don't take it the wrong way, people, but there's shocked. Yeah, okay. But the reality is that we actually had for sex a few years ago, we had an open line for people to tell us their fantasies. And one of the fantasies, it's all with no names. One of the fantasies was a guy or girl or guy that told us, they told us that their fantasy is to take high heels and actually somebody, a porn star, to have sex with him with high heels. So it's something that is out there.
Yeah. It's been for in a lot of ancient Japanese erotica, horns of animals that were carved into like dildo shapes and were attached to a woman's ankle and her heel so she could sit there with this inside of her. She could put a kimono all over it so it could be all nice and quiet and private. So it's not a new thing.
Yeah. It actually sounds completely cultural and traditional.
Yeah. So share with us on WeChat and our WhatsApp number, 079-748-2090, your questions, your comments. We are live, and we are live on Twitter at?
Twitter at sextalk_CliffC.
Fantastic.
That's it. And please get your comments going. It's a topic that we know from Twitter that you guys have been reacting and sharing and reposting, and it's a topic that touches all of us.
Yeah. So the inspiration for the show, where it came from, was Amy, my daughter, telling me about the app that Becky Sisa developed. Mia, tell us about that, please. That was the start of this journey.
Sure. So Vicky Sisa is the health desk of the Mail and Guardian.
Okay.
And we do quite a few long-form stories about societal issues. So in October 2015, we published a long story about rape in a Johannesburg township called Diepsloot. And I spent quite a bit of time, about a week in Diepsloot, with various victims and survivors. And the one thing that was common about everyone that I interviewed in the story was that no one had access to any help. They would report it to the police, but nothing would happen. But most importantly, no one had access to any counseling afterwards. The only organization, there was a small unfunded organization called the Green Door, of really one guy volunteering and counseling people at night. That was the only place that they could contact, and obviously the capacity wasn't big enough.
So when it was being reported and there was no help, was that because there were no resources available?
People didn't know about the resources.
Okay.
So they thought if there's not a government place that can help you, there's no help.
Okay.
Now, there's no government hospital close or nearby Diepsloot. There are only two clinics, and they don't stock rape kits or have rape counseling. There was really only the police station. And if they didn't get help there, they felt there is no help available. But meanwhile, there were these five organizations, non-governmental organizations, which did do work in Diepsloot, but no one knows. And as you could imagine, Diepsloot is a very big place. People estimate there's about 500,000 people living there.
Wow.
And a recent study, actually, that was released last year, late last year, by one of the organizations, Sonke Gender Justice, that works there, showed that when they asked men, have you beaten or have you raped a woman? 56% of the men said they had raped or beaten a woman, and 60% said they had done so more than once. Now, you could imagine.
That's horrendous. It's almost inconceivable that.
If you work it out, if you assume there's 500,000 people living there, it's not an official figure, it's what people estimate, it's about 150,000 women needing access to counseling. And no one knew where to find this help. So as a result of the article, we got a lot of responses and the Green Door got a lot of donations, but still no one had access to enough help. We thought we would like to help in some way to connect people to the services that are available. Mm. So we started the Vimbel helpline, not alone. It would obviously be quite stupid to start it alone because we're just a media organization. We're not the people providing the help. We just want to link people. Mm. So there are five organizations, the Green Door that I mentioned. There's a gender organization, Sonke Gender Justice. There's an organization called Lawyers Against Abuse. Another one called Africa Tikkun, and another one the South African Association of Depression and Anxiety, that can help people with counseling. So we partnered with those organizations to create an app where you'd need no data on your phone, because you could imagine that people in Diepsloot are not going to have the money to use an app that requires data. And so it uses special technology where you can dial a number. And as soon as you dial this number, it would ask you, where are you based in Diepsloot? It would ask you, what's your language? It's available in English, Sepedi, and Zulu. It would ask you four questions. Have you been raped? Do you want to help someone who's been raped? Or have you been beaten or abused? And do you want to help someone who's been raped, beaten or abused? And as soon as you select one of those, it will SMS you for free all the details of these organizations, where to get hold of them, also the police and the ambulance. And it would at the same time record where are you calling from, what time of the day are you calling from, what time of the month, so that the organizations that provides the help can use this information to determine, you know, when is help the most needed? What time of the month is help the most needed? When do they need to make more people available for help? And we're hoping it was launched on the 30th of November, so we only have 1 month of data so far. But we're hoping that the trends that it sets will help these organizations to also target their funding at those areas and times of the month when it's most needed.
So what's happened in the month since it's been launched? What's the response been?
So we've had overwhelming response. When we received the data for December, it was about four times higher than we thought it would have been. We thought initially, because it's only in Diepsloot, right? We would have about 50 people calling in. We had about 300 calling in, and most of the people selected the option where they said, I have been abused myself or beaten. happen. Now, of course, it's a month in which the app was tried out, so some of these responses could very well have been people just checking it out.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that most people also contacted sort of during the daytime, so it might be after the previous night. And there was a big spike. Obviously, there was a spike on the 1st of December, just the day after it was launched. But there was a very big spike on the 16th of December, which was a long weekend and which is associated with a lot of alcohol.
But also that's the time of activism around.
Yes, yeah, that's a time of activism. Yeah. But specifically that day, it was on Friday, you know. Yes. And all the people always that we talk to say the closer it's to a holiday or when there's more time, for instance, for alcohol or people are hanging around.
So those
around
are definitely contributing factors? Alcohol plays a big part in this?
Well, research definitely shows that alcohol plays a significant part in rape. It doesn't make you rape, but it's a contextual factor where it goes to both sides. It makes someone, a victim, more vulnerable because you're not as alert as you could be. It's not your fault that you got raped, but you're less alert. And it also makes abusers more violent. There's lots of research that shows that, and it makes you have fewer inhibitions. So it's lots of there are so many studies showing that is associated. Yeah.
You know, that's interesting because in our world, which is more a world of sexual exploration, very often a lot of people go and do things under the influence of alcohol that they would not otherwise do. And it's somewhere along that spectrum of that. And we've always said, if you cannot do the stone cold sober, then don't do it. Full stop. And I would imagine this is somewhere along that spectrum with the same kind of idea.
Absolutely, yeah.
You would not do that in a sober space. Mm.
You know, you would be more, you would have more inhibitions. Filters, yeah. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So from the research that you've done, something has come up that the idea of why people rape.
Yes, yes.
What have you come to about that? I don't know if we have a definitive answer, but let's.
So, of course, there's obviously not just one answer, right?
Yeah,
there's lots of. So, they're things that I'm more familiar with.
Yeah.
And in my research, I have. The thing that has struck me most, and it's obviously not the only reason why people rape, obviously, rape is an act of violence.
Yeah.
It has very little to do with sex.
Yeah.
But for me, the most intriguing part, and perhaps it's my interest or just like our country, is that there's a huge body of research showing that if you were a boy and you were abused as a child, you are significantly more likely to become an abuser as an adult.
Regardless of the form of that abuse. If it was by a male, by a female.
Regardless who abused you. Mm. And actually, in the Dipsluit and the Sonke Change trial that came out last year, that it showed that 85% of the men who were interviewed, and remember, more than half of them said they have raped or beaten a woman, said they were abused as children, not necessarily sexually, sexually, physically, or just neglected. Research also shows that if you were a girl and you were abused as a child, you are then far more likely to become a victim again as an adult. And in a way, in South Africa, many people or researchers would argue that we are breeding a nation of victims and of abusers.
Yeah, this rape, it's a culture that's become ingrained in so many aspects of our society.
The first study last year that came out, it was a national study that told us how many children do get abused, showed it was called the Optimus Study, and it was released by the University of Cape Town. And it showed by the time that a child in South Africa reaches the age of 17, one out of three has been sexually abused. Mm. Now, there's a definition of sexually abused there. It's not just being abused yourself. It's if you had to, like, if you were forced to watch pornography or if you're forced to look at people having sex, but also being abused, of course. And one of the things that really contribute to being abused is the type of household you grow up in, how much protection there is. And obviously, if you have two parents present, it doesn't mean you won't get abused, but there's a less of a physical chance, research shows, that you would get abused, of course, if both parents are intact and if they look after you. And in South Africa, only one, our stats South Africa data shows, only one out of three children in South Africa grow up in a household where there are two parents present, which makes children more vulnerable, obviously. Yeah. And mostly they only grow up with a mother.
Mm. So a lot of the studies that have been done would be in areas like Dipsluit. Across the board, if you take the same kind of information and put that into Santon, for example. Have studies been done in those areas as well?
Far fewer studies have been done in those areas. And of course, one of the arguments that people use is, why do you just focus on Diepsloot and why do you just focus on townships, basically?
From the factors you've said, we understand that that's more prevalent there. There's no question. But it has to exist in other areas as well. It has to exist in the more affluent areas.
Absolutely.
Because it's about people.
Absolutely.
Not just the social context that we live in.
It's about people, and whether you're wealthy or poor does not make you more likely to be a sexual abuser. But what does make you more likely in a poor area is, of course, the amount of protection that's available. Yeah. So, for instance, one of the things that came out from our app in the first month is that most of the calls were from Extension 1. There are 13 extensions in Diepsloot. It's the poorest and most under-resourced section. Of course, people who tried it out could just also have selected number 1 because it's the first month. But there is a lot of research showing that if there's more protection, it's less likely. But you're absolutely right. Sexual abuse happens everywhere. It happens in affluent areas, and it has nothing to do with you don't become a different type of person.
Yeah, because people are people.
Yes.
And we tend to get more shocked when we hear somebody like Hayley sitting here has had that kind of experience as opposed to somebody in Diepsloot. And that tends to shock us more, maybe because of we can relate more to that in a way.
Absolutely. I think we're all used to hearing about more stories and the statistics in the poorer areas.
Yeah.
But it is prevalent through every area.
Yeah, regardless. Because that's people. And to expect people to be different just because they live somewhere else is an absurd idea. So the question then comes in that space, would it be more kind of hidden? Would it be more because we tend to conceal a lot of social issues, like in a more affluent area? A lot of stuff would be more, we don't talk about this. Mm. Your father's an alcoholic, or your father's an abuser, or your father's a drug addict, or your mother is having multiple. We don't talk about that.
Definitely behind closed doors.
Yeah, so we'd hide it much more. Does that exist, do you think?
I would imagine it does. I have not read the research in that area, so
if there is any,
I cannot imagine that there's none. There should be. But of course, if you live in a house where with more rooms and more. Of course, it's easier to hide it. And of course, if it's in a society where it's so unacceptable or where it's not acceptable to talk about it, then of course you will talk about it less. But I do think there is research. I just haven't studied all of it. In middle-class areas, and pedophiles you find so commonly in middle-class areas.
Yeah, and that's across the board. And I get a sense, not that that's growing, but that more people have access to, you know, because of the internet. So, for example, more people have access to child porn than ever before. So it's not that that never existed before. And I don't know if the amount of people are growing. It's just simply more people are coming out of the closet, for want of a better word.
I want to just put to clarify for myself, when we talk about rape and when we talk about molesting or pedophilia, or any kind of other sexual violence, we have to be specific as well. There's different stats around that, and rape, as we discussed just now, and that's why Mia explained that before the show, that she's now working on another, how to continue those, you know, this exposure around rape and what actually causes it. But then again, when we talk about some kind of mental issue with sexuality, or a health issue with sexuality disorders, it's very different, because they're very different, because there is stats that are scary around rape, okay, and around actually that it's not even wrong. One of the things that I got from your article, Mia, is that, you know, men saying it's not wrong, it's I paid her, I can, you know, she,
I can do what I like.
I can do what I like, or the child, I gave him some sweets. It's a fair trade, you know, to take advantage of vulnerability of a victim. Somebody was a victim, not even understanding. Even the attacker itself doesn't understand that he's doing something wrong.
That's why I said this is such an overwhelming issue, because the depth of it, or the culture that's bred this, has so many different aspects. So I would imagine, for example, in Diepsloot, such a lack of education plays such a part of it. And not only school education, but education about being a human being, being a person, what that means and the impact that has.
So one of the things that, research shows on why men rape is that is how they perceive it, what it means to be a man, the perception of masculinity. And in this Sonki trial, they asked men, sort of like, you know, what do you think about women? And there are some very, very interesting figures. They found that a lot of men, and I actually wrote them down on a paper for you, just to, that they associated, it's not a cause, but they associated it with violence against women, that 76% of the men, and these were 2,600 men that they spoke to, had sexually entitled views, as in believing that a woman is not allowed to refuse sex if she's your partner. And many of them had what they call gender inequitable views. So in other words, they don't think men and women are equal and men should make decisions for women. And that's very closely associated with the rights that they think a woman could have or that men think it can have. They also found that about a third of the men who did commit violence against women had 7 sexual partners or more. So there's association with more sexual partners, increasing number of sexual partners and how you treat women. And lots of them were depressed. About 50% of them with a screening test tested depressed. And they did find that there were things that prevented men from rape. That's specifically just in depth fluid. One of the things was age. They found if a man was 27 years and older, there was a less of a chance for violence. So it's not just raping, it's also beating, physical violence. They found if a man was employed, it was significantly less likely that he would abuse a woman. You could imagine there's less time, and they felt more worthy because they contributed. And another interesting thing was that if a man lived in a house where there was food security, so if there was enough food for everyone in that house, they were less likely to be violent towards women.
Goes back to very much to a lot of Viktor Frankl's teachings, and his great book, Man's Search for Meaning. And he was in the concentration camps in the Second World War and came out of that with the understanding, he's a psychiatrist, and came out of that with the understanding that firstly, people who survived that had some level of meaning in their lives. It didn't have to be world-changing meaning, but it could be incredibly small and seemingly insignificant. But if there was meaning, we could survive so much. And he extended this into a whole field of therapy called logotherapy, based on finding meaning, that what he discovered was if there was some kind of meaning in life, so many, to put it in clinical parlance, psychoses and neuroses tended to disappear if we had meaning, regardless of what that was. And there's an extension of that that's quite fascinating in terms of a new model of addiction that's come out, that's found that as soon as people have a level of meaning and a contribution and a connection to society, so many addictions tend to fall away. And they've done that in Portugal with the most amazing results, where they legalized all drugs and then took a whole lot of addicts and actually gave them jobs and found something to do, and addiction disappeared. So it kind of really makes sense that. So the bigger picture of this is such a deeper social context.
Yeah.
And if you look at saying there are around 500,000 people living in this incredible space of lack, how do you change that? And it's literally sitting here, it's like this overwhelming thing. What do you do to change that? I wouldn't even know where to start with something like that.
What that trial is trying to do is to have workshops with men to change their perceptions on gender, and they're going to measure if it's worked in about a year from now. But the interesting thing was when they try to get venues in which they can run these workshops, because you need like 20 men or so, you know, a space that's big enough, they couldn't find any public spaces in Diepsloot other than Shebeens that were big enough to accommodate these men. So they're having it in Shebeens. And there's lots of research showing that the less recreation people have, the more likely they are to drink and get involved in other things. So perhaps one of the solutions in a place like Diepsloot is to also look at, like you say, to add more meaning. Are there sort of venues available where people could do meaningful things, and you need public spaces other than schools for that? And that would be a big issue. And if you look at the city of Johannesburg's budget at the moment, only 1% of Diepsloot's budget is allocated to addressing social issues. There's only one park in a place like Diepsloot, a recreational park, that's in a working order for people to do anything meaningful or to have exercise or do anything where they feel worthy. So yes, there are very few things available to make people feel like there's something they can do with their lives. And you could imagine the unemployment rates and stuff. Yeah.
Bigger picture. The stats of the amount of rape in South Africa on a daily, monthly basis. Do you have any idea of that?
I don't have that with me at the moment. And there's not very reliable stats.
Yeah. What we know from the Maboneng exhibition, that all the panties hanging, they said there's 3,400 cases of rape reported daily.
But there was a lot of controversy around
that.
Yes, yeah.
But let's say it's thousands without even, that's only the ones that are being reported.
Yeah.
So that's the numbers that we came across. But it's not something that we know, because there's so many areas that
are. So from what we've said, I would imagine then that the resources to help people, to help victims then, would be so determined by area.
Well, yeah, but if you go to a place like Diepsloot and you hear that 56% of men say they've abused a woman, and there's not a single rape government clinic available, then you wouldn't think
so. So doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so that's squarely at the feet of the government
It's changing. You know, in Israel, only 11 years ago, the legislation changed from a husband can't rape his wife. You know, in Israel, you consider as a quite liberal. In Ireland, in America, only recently, a husband can't, you know, ask sex whenever he wants.
But so much of that is actually based in religion.
True. And we know, you know, from the therapy room, how many wives and how many ladies come to you and say, I'm a victim of my own, in my own house.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff it is. Hayley, tell us your story.
Nearly 2 years ago, I went out to a local restaurant in Durban to meet up with a friend. I arrived there, ordered a glass of wine. My friend called and said that she couldn't meet me, couldn't get a babysitter. So I thought I'd finish my glass of wine and go. Someone spiked my drink in that short time. And I have no memory from arriving at the restaurant until the following morning, waking up in a strange bed with bruises and blood all over, and then just running like hell, half naked, trying to find where I was. And then over the next few weeks, all the memories from the Rohypnol that was given to me started coming back again and again. So I had to relive the experience again and again, and it wasn't just one man, it was three men. I managed to find the one man, but the trauma that caused me as an adult, when you don't think a 40-something-year-old woman is going to be raped and drugged by a man in his 50s, a respectable-looking man, in the horse racing industry. So he had access to a lot of horse drugs as well. So that was also part of what was put into my drink. So... yeah, it took me a very long time to stop or to process all the memories. They would just arrive out of nowhere, and it would be replayed until it was finished, until I could no longer handle it, until I had healed that part of me. Very little support from people in general, because people don't know how to deal with someone who's been abused or hurt.
Yeah. When it embarrasses us and we don't know how to be with somebody in that space. Did you report this?
I didn't know. I was so overwhelmed and so shocked. And it took me literally 2 days to come down from the drug. And then I went to the hospital and got checked, HIV and all of that. But it was too late for DNA. And then it took me some time to track this man. Well, the one of the men, I haven't found the other ones yet. But yeah, going back to people's support is what you need the most as a rape survivor. But nobody knows how to deal with you, so they tell you just to get on with your life and stop thinking about it. And I think that was the most hurtful and the hardest part of my process. So we are helping others in educating people to know how to support anybody who's been abused or raped.
What would you have wanted or needed in terms of support?
Just an ear and a hug.
Mm-hmm.
That's simple as that.
Mm.
Not to be told, oh, we shouldn't have done that, or we shouldn't have gone out alone, and made me feel like I was the guilty one and I deserved it.
That's a big point.
Yeah, and it happens so much where women are made to feel the victim.
You asked for it.
That you caused this.
Absolutely.
The way you dressed, the way that you behaved. And that comes up, it's probably not a week that goes past that we don't hear something like that.
Absolutely. And it's a conditioning that we brought up with that even in, as an educated and a therapist myself, I was doubting myself. I'm like, did I deserve it? Did I bring it on? Should I have not gone out alone in a respected area in Durban in a beautiful restaurant?
Mm.
So that self-doubt is such deep conditioning that needs to be changed to our children.
Yeah. Mia, should every, by law, is every police station supposed to have a rape kit, a rape-trained counselor?
I'm not sure about that. Mm. What I do know is that we've got rape counseling centers that at the moment is experiencing a lack of funding, but it seems like that government centers, that the Tuduzela centers, that seems like they are starting to get funding again.
Mm.
But you get back to the reporting things. So I'm busy with a follow-up story on the influence of alcohol on sexual abuse.
Mm.
And one of the interesting things in the research is that, of course, if a woman drank, she is not responsible for a man raping her, right? Mm. That doesn't give anyone the right to rape you. But they found that if you did have a drink or two, women are far less likely to report the rape because of self-guilt and what Hayley mentioned now. And then they're far less likely to access help.
Mm.
So, and they also found that a police officer or social worker's response to you, if you had a drink, for instance, as well, is very different to if only the perpetrator was drinking.
Wow.
So they already put a stigma on you and it wasn't your fault, right? Yes, perhaps you were more vulnerable, but that's not, no one has the right to rape or abuse another person. So it's a very, perceptual thing, and it's a very stigmatized thing, right, Hayley, where drinking can be stigmatized, or if you went to a restaurant alone. But yes, of course, you're more vulnerable, but it doesn't mean anyone has the right to abuse you.
Yeah.
And that whole thing around it of then accessing help or reporting it becomes so much more difficult to do it.
Yeah. So much comes from what we believe about ourselves as men, about what we believe as men about women, women about men, what everybody has a right to.
And one of the things that's so crucial to access, not necessarily emotionally, but for your physical health, is that if you want to, you know, violent sex, in violent sex, which is associated with rape, right, you're so much more likely to become infected with HIV than in sex with no trauma associated with it. And you can get drugs for free from the government to prevent HIV infection, and it's really effective, but you need to take it within 72 hours. Then it's no longer really effective afterwards. And if you embarrassed and if you didn't access help, you wouldn't be able to access that, and it's available for free. And it's so important. That's one of the things that our app also does. It sends you where you can find these things or tells you what you need to access. And if it's so stigmatized, how will you access that help? You know, it's the difference between becoming infected and not infected. And if you look at HIV statistics, you know, for instance, if you got raped, say, near a bin or a place of drinking, HIV infection rates among heavy drinkers is so much higher, so it's almost more likely that someone raped you that could have been infected, that it's so, so important that we destigmatize it and that we help people to access that kind of help that's only available, you know, within a certain number of hours after it happened.
Yeah. What is the impact on your sexuality of this?
Sure. Initially, I completely shut down. I was recently divorced, so I was alone.
You were divorced before the rape?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I only been alone, single for a few months, so it really threw me. My confidence as a single woman was completely shattered. And I went through moments of wanting to dominate men to killing them, sexually, physically. I would play it again and again in my mind as to, just from my own hurt, how can I find my power back through this kind of horrific kind of thinking? Mm. But it was real, and that's, you know.
So an incredible level of anger.
Oh, huge.
Indescribable almost anger.
Absolutely. And I still, I could kill. I get triggered every so often by something and it overwhelms me how angry I still am. Mm. So it takes time, a long time to process.
Yeah, I would imagine it's not a quick healing at all.
And I think this is something that I really, really want to share and get out there, that it's not something you just get over. I must have been told 100 times, oh, come on, stop thinking about it, get on with your life. Mm. And that's such a slap in the face. I said, well, be in my body for just one day and feel what it feels like to have that memory in your body, to have an injured neck from being raped by 3 men and being hurt. And that is with me every day. So don't tell me to get over it. So I want to encourage people to be as kind and as gentle and as supportive as possible. Mm. We don't need fixing. We're not broken. We need compassion and we need love so we can heal.
How important is that system? How sacred is our sexuality, our bodies? It's really the only thing that is completely private, and it's ours. Absolutely. And when it's being taken away from us, this is not something, there's a very big misperception. There's an unbelievable misperception of what is somebody taking over your power. It's just a physical thing, right? That's so many people that haven't. So think of a child that's why Mia is also pointing out that children that are being abused in such a young age, their chances in life to actually not become abusers themselves is very low, because their whole psychological ecosystem, let's call it, is being completely influenced by it. Mm. And you are a grown, beautiful woman who is extremely intelligent and in her power, and yet again you're saying it's I need compassion, I need the support.
Yeah. Interesting thought. The amount of relationships that survive a partner being raped. Any idea on that, Mia? Would you have any idea? I'm sure there are some studies out there, but it was just, it's an interesting thing. Mm. We're going to come back to this topic in a month or so, because there are so many different aspects of it, and that would be an interesting thing to look at. Just how many relationships or the impact of a partner being raped on a relationship.
Mm. One of my closest friends was raped, and she described it as a moment that she actually chose either to live or die after the rape. She chose to live a beautiful, full life. She was also a 23-year-old woman, and she was completely conscious when the rape happened, but she actually just, she broke up with her boyfriend eventually, because in a sense she had to let go of a part of herself and to recreate herself. And also she grew a lot from it. It was a platform of actually saying, no, I'm not going to let this ruin my life.
Absolutely.
Yes, for a few years she couldn't walk in the dark. Yes, for a few years she couldn't have sex. Yes, for a few years she couldn't trust anybody, but she said, I'm not letting this go. I'm not letting this go. And when she grew, she a little bit also outgrew her boyfriend, because he stayed in that place wanting to protect her, and she was already a full, let's say, reborn woman.
Exactly.
And it destroys. You think about different civil wars in parts of the world where systematic rape is used as an instrument of absolute destruction.
In the Bible, they mention it even, that they use it to destroy a nation, a village.
That it's happened in Africa, in Serbia, in those conflicts. Where
Rwanda.
Literally, systemic rape of populations of women by men.
The kidnapping of their girls.
And not only the impact on women, but the impact on the men who are put in the space and conditioned to do this. And it's probably the biggest bastardization of our sexuality. Of something so beautiful, that's the depth of it.
And the impact on the children who get born as a result of that, right?
Yeah. Mm. And that's, as you've said, from what the research is showing, that just continues. Why is that, Mia? Why do you think that is? What is the trigger that says, because this was done to me, I'm going to do this?
So, I need to think. So I think it has to do with, if you damaged and that damage was not addressed, and in very few cases it does get addressed, it becomes a vicious circle. It's the same with physical abuse. If someone grows up in a household where, say, a father is physically violent towards a mother, the person is more likely to turn out to do that as well. And many people would, for instance, many researchers would define, say, the definition of physical violence also just looking at it, even if you weren't, if the child wasn't hit, if the child had to see the mother or father being physically violent. And I think it has to do with damage that hasn't been addressed. And the same with if you were a girl and you were a victim. There's also, for instance, in this Dipslut study, it shows that even adults that had to view trauma or to experience trauma, to view violence as an adult, say in Dipslut, was 60% more likely to then abuse someone as well. It has to do with the impact that it has on you. I do not know all the details of, you know, exactly what the system is, but I guess it has to do with processing it and not being equipped to do that.
And we're not given the tools to do that.
Mm. Yeah.
It's amazing because in some ways we are so strong and in some ways we are so fucking fragile and delicate.
Yeah. And there was this one boy actually that I didn't interview the boy, but I interviewed a sort of a therapist of the boy. And he was 8 or 9 years old and in a class, and the teacher left and he started to take out his penis and he told the girl in the class, suck it. And the teacher and the children started to scream and came back and said, why are you doing this? You know, what's wrong with you? And it came out, his response was to the therapist, I want to feel what it feels like, because he was living with four men, and every evening that he went home, he had to do this to men. So there's also a lot of imitation, you know, and just wanting to figure out what is this. Mm. And you could imagine on a child, the impact, they don't understand the sexuality around it. It's just something that they get taught to do. And this, of course, you know, it doesn't just happen in Dipslut. It happens in middle-class areas. It happens everywhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's amazing. You know, my world is one of generally the beauty of sexuality. And this just takes it to such an unimaginable space for so many of us in a way. It's, yeah.
Mm, absolutely.
Mm, it really, really does. But again, it shows how important even basic sex education is, and a forum for people to be able to talk about this from the time that they're really, really young and really, really small.
And understanding essential. What is theirs, what is rightfully theirs, what are their rights?
Mm. Yeah.
What are their basic rights, even if they grow up in a house, that they can understand something that doesn't make sense, because what they're taught in school or in some sort of community doesn't sit with what happens in their house, then they can at least understand it's wrong.
How many schools are there in Dipslut?
I have no idea. I haven't. I can.
You know, I guess the question would be: does every child who lives there go to school?
I don't know.
I have no idea either.
Yeah, I don't know the figures on that. But there are quite a few schools. There are private schools as well. Obviously, low, cheap private schools. Yeah. But I know that Tsonki is in the process of making a list of how many Shabins there are, and there are definitely more Shabins than schools.
Than schools, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And it's fascinating how the influence of alcohol on so many things is enormous. And our society is so happy to promote alcohol. And something like dope comes along and, wow, that causes a war all by itself. I'm not saying that we should all go out and smoke dope. But the fact that we are so happy to promote the substance that really we know it makes people angry. We know it makes people aggressive. And yet we're so happy for it to be in absolute abundance, supply and availability.
Absolutely. And also the alcohol gives you no control, I think.
Yeah.
Where people have been able to control themselves sober aren't able to control themselves under the influence.
Absolutely. Yeah, fuck, we've got it wrong, hey?
Yeah.
And research also shows that women who have been abused are more likely to drink afterwards as a coping mechanism, right? And that in turn makes them more vulnerable again to being abused again,
If they have to leave the house again, let me tell you.
So from what you've been saying, Hayley, is that treatment and therapy for this in whatever way somebody chooses, and I think when we come back to this, that's going to be the focus of what we look at, becomes... It's really long term.
It is very much.
It's not like 2 or 3 counseling sessions and you're done with this.
Mm. I think on a physical level, the sexology of the Tantra work that was done for me certainly helped to process the fear around my body and for me to reconnect with my body, not to hate it. But the psychological damage, it is ongoing. So even now, 2 years down the line, I still have my wobbles. Mm. So I still need help as I go, and as many people do. And some people keep quiet for 10, 15 years before they share their stories.
Yeah.
And since I've started helping rape victims themselves, I'm hearing stories that people have never shared to another living soul. Mm. You know what that does? It eats you up inside.
Yeah.
So I just encourage people to share and to get it out of their bodies, out of their heads, out.
Because as you've said, once a woman admits to having been abused, having been raped, there's enormous stigma directed at her.
Huge judgments. Huge judgment. I lost many friends and family members because people could not understand me or be there for me.
Mm.
So I'd rather not deal with people that were judging me afterwards so harshly. And these are friends and people that love you, but they have no capacity to understand how to be. Instead of telling you to buck up, saying, come, let me give you a hug. How can I help you?
Mm. I just read a story in one of Israel's most respected newspapers that a 17-year-old a few years ago was raped in a club. We had a gangbang group rape. And she was under the influence, but she remembers what happened, and of course the whole court case and everything, but she couldn't cope. And she didn't get enough support, and she just went into drugs, and she wanted to get more drugs, so she went into being a prostitute, and she died from overdose yesterday or a few days ago. And it's a young girl, it's a young, beautiful, vibrant girl that wants attention from guys, and, you know, we are all sexual beings, we use our beautiful appearance, or we want to be attractive. That's what also the media and commercials tell us, be attractive, be beautiful, you know, show everything, because that's how you're going to be successful, or just have a lot of attention. And then we actually understand that it needs to come with consciousness. It needs to come with owning what are we presenting. And yes, don't tell me how to dress, but definitely be in a position that you are, at least that you can be in a place that you know you can minimize the risk. You can be in a place that you have self-esteem. You know that you are worth a lot. I have very young sisters, and they all tell me about their friends that get a lot of attention from sexual relationships. And if they're in the wrong environment, or one wrong friend, or one not so stable, and I'm talking about, you know, people from a very high socioeconomical, you know, background. And a lot of our friends, they don't even admit for it to be rape, but it was, you know, they went home.
We'll justify, explain, we'll make something else. Because we can't deal with it, and we don't have a structure, and we know that the people around us can't deal with it. Yeah. Mia, where do you intend to take this? Where's the next step? What's the development
of the app or the story? So,
yeah.
We are hoping to be able to see trends of reporting rape and physical abuse also of women in Deep Sluit, and then to meet with the partners that we have and get their input, because the whole thing was really done with their input, and see where to take it. You know, perhaps there's enough data that tells us, you know what, we need an emergency line that someone can man, and we need funding for that. Remember, we're just a media organization, so we're the link in the communication, but, you know, perhaps that's what they can apply for. Perhaps it works really well in Deep Sluit, and it can be replicated in other places, not necessarily townships, universities.
Yeah.
You know,
there is not a two-week period that goes past where a rape on some campus somewhere is not
reported.
Yeah. Yes. And that's probably, once again, the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. And in terms of stories, you know, I'd love to publish another long-form feature on alcohol and the links, you know, not just to rape, but like to...
Most dangerous drug.
To health, like, you know, to HIV, to unintended pregnancies. And, you know, stories can be so powerful if they're told through people, and not just through stats, and if they're humanized. But it takes a long time to get them to that level. So that's the next project I'm working on, yeah.
Hayley, that's why it's so important that you are here, because when we hear status, you know, it's statistics.
Mm.
And this child and that child and that woman.
And it's the separate thing. So it's these people who live in a township. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with me on some level.
Yeah, or that girl, she was just asking for so many things run through our heads. It's like, no, she might, yeah.
But that's me. Because, you know, there's something. Tamara and I were at a Biodanza experience on Wednesday night. And one of the things that the facilitator, Christos, our friend, said at some point, your heart is mine and my heart is yours. And in the simple truth of the connection of life, every one of these experiences impacts on us.
Us is connected.
And, yeah. And the deeper and the horrifying truth of it is, on some level, we've all given consent for that to be in existence in our world because of its existence. And healing ourselves in this becomes so important, and living more from ourselves in that space of love. I had a really fascinating insight yesterday of, if we were taught to love ourselves more, how different our lives would be.
Oh, yes.
How much less of these kinds of things would there be, but really taught to love yourself. I look back at my life, I look at the hurt that I've caused, the hurt that has caused me. Learning to love myself more, would I have done so many of them? No way.
Mm.
Would any of us have?
Mm.
And maybe that's what we need to be educating people about.
Absolutely.
Never mind where the fuck is Antarctica.
Mm.
I mean, that's important. Mm. It's useless because you have Google today, so you can look up and you can put into Google, where the fuck is Antarctica? And Google will tell you exactly where Antarctica is. Learning to love ourselves more, we would not do this.
Mm.
We would live differently.
I think that would help so many rape survivors as well, having the basis of learning that, being easier to to heal yourself and to rebuild yourself, because you despise yourself. And to go from scratch after rape is the longest, hardest journey that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder and all sorts of other addictions and afflictions. So,
and moving away from being a victim and not getting stuck up and holding on to that.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a horrendous experience. There's no question of that. But living the fullness of life. And that becomes a part of the fabric of who you are. There's no question of that.
Absolutely.
And experience that deep. It sits in your body. It sits in your cells. It sits in your tissues. There's no question of that. But from loving ourselves more, we change and we heal this.
Absolutely.
And teaching our children. And, you know, I get asked a lot, how do you teach your children about sex? And it's an interesting answer, but I had an amazing insight 2 or 3 weeks ago. You want to teach your children something, teach them how to get help.
So,
teach them when they need it, the right kind of therapy, the right kind of healing, the right kind of mentorship, the right people to talk to. You want to teach your children something, teach them how to get help when they need it. We can't do any of this stuff alone, none of us. And we're all in this together.
Absolutely.
And every child that gets raped and every woman that gets raped is my child and my woman. So what the fuck are we doing in our world? Thank you for sharing with us. I don't know what more I can say. We wish you so much pleasure. CliffCentral.com.